The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
good evening, everyone. And can you hear all right, everyone? Okay. There's been a long custom in Buddhism for Buddhist practitioners to have teachers. And teachers have had a very important role for offering guidance, for offering feedback, for reflection, for teachings, for many things. But one of the goals of teachers is to help you not need the teachers anymore. So and in doing so, becoming your own teacher. And between those two, between having a teacher and becoming your own teacher, there's something that can be your teacher that's very effective, very useful. And that is your sense of ease. That whatever sense of ease that you know can become your teacher. It can teach you a lot. It can teach you a lot about yourself, and it can challenge you in great, wonderful ways. It's a wonderful debating partner. I'll talk about that a little bit today. You can debate with ease, and chances are is you'll lose the debate. So the ease. One of the most succinct ways of thinking about ease as a Buddhist practice is some instructions that a Buddhist monk named Ajahn Amaro liked to give. He was an Englishman who lived here in California for many years. And his most simple instructions for meditation are to set yourself at ease to whatever degree that you can, and then notice what takes you away from it. That's it. So to notice what takes you away helps you to see a lot about yourself. And you get to see what's probably very important to understand. Because a lot of the wisdom, the way of being a teacher, really understand something in the Buddha's teaching, is to understand something about yourself. And to understand how you get caught, how you get caught up in attachments and clinging and fear and aversion, in ambition and desire, in conceit, in self-aggrandizement, self-diminishment, all the kind of games of self. So to become familiar how this works. And not a few people who come to something like Buddhism are interested in the wonderfulness of practice. They're looking for, sometimes they're looking for great enlightenment, they're looking for wonderful spiritual experiences, they're looking for joy, they're looking for deep concentrated states, all this kind of like the good stuff, kind of. And those certainly has a role in practice, but in pursuing that, many people are blinded from really understanding themselves and really understanding how they their operating system of how we get caught. And a wise person in the Buddhist teachings is intimately familiar with all the tricks of the mind, all the little ways and big ways that we get tripped up, we get caught, we get fixated by all kinds of things. So this instructions, notice what takes you away from the ease, allows the ease to be a mirror to help you see yourself more clearly, what you're actually doing. And it might be quite surprising if you do this regularly through the day to see what it is that trips you up. Where does your mind go? Where does it get stuck? A wonderful place to do this is on retreats, because then people are kind of paying attention all day long, or much of the day, And people start noticing patterns that they sometimes don't notice in ordinary daily life because we're kind of half the time distracted in daily life. You're not really paying attention, not really noticing what's going on. And one of the things that some people notice is how much fear there is in the mind and how much fear is operating. Sometimes they notice it's an underlying prevalent kind of foundation for everything else that they do. However, they don't really notice it because it's so deep and they're so distracted and caught up in what's on the surface. Some people will notice how much selfing there is, how much there's constant concern about me, myself, and mine. I saw that when I was in Japan. I practiced in a monastery there for a while, and I was learning Japanese when I was there. And so my Japanese was rudimentary, but I had to speak Japanese because there was no one to speak English to in the monastery. And so in Japanese, it's very rare to use pronouns. So, you know, you don't say, you know, I'm going, you say going. And so in the context of the situation, you understand that I'm going, you're going, they're going, you just, they say going, and the people somehow understand the context. So it kind of makes sentences a little bit simpler than in English, where we add the I'm going. There is a way of saying I am going, but in English we say it, with one syllable, I. In Japanese, you need three syllables and a preposition, so which is another syllable, so four syllables, and it goes by the way. Watashi wa. So if you want to say I'm going, you say watashi wa ikimasu. So it's kind of a mouthful. Well, I was learning how to speak Japanese, and so I tried to speak it like you speak English. And so it was such a strong instinct for me, habit, to use the I word, because in English we use it all the time. And so I would start, most of my sentences with watashi wa. And the Japanese monks, it's kind of not, a little bit strange. It started to sound really strange for me, how often I was doing it. And I became acutely aware of how much my speech was oriented around me, myself, and mine. But you can also become aware of that in your mind, how much your thoughts orient around me, myself, and mine. Now, some of that's just fine, and it's innocent enough, but some of it is probably a little bit an over-preoccupation with self. And I suspect that a fair number of people, if they really kind of kept the statistics, kept count of what they're thinking about, they find a very high percentage of them are self-centered in ways which are not so exemplary. And so, but more importantly, for this exercise of ease, look at your ease and then notice what takes you away from it, is you'll discover that it's concern about self that sometimes trips us up. We lose our sense of ease because of it. Someone says something and our mind starts making a story about what that means. And as we tell that story, then it's about me, myself, and mine. We get all excited. I've had situations where I was sitting mindfully, minding my own business, and there was something like a sound or something happened, or just something, I don't know what happens in my mind, but I remember a college girlfriend, from over 40 years ago, and she said, I said, she did. And I should have said, why didn't I say? How could she do it to me? And, just like I fall into it, and as I do it, I feel my mind contract, feel the heat go up. And it's all thoughts about me, myself, and mine. And, that I'm still kind of living out, so many years later. So put yourself in some modicum of ease, and then notice what takes you away from it. And try to look at that in a compassionate way. Try to look at that with kindness and just matter-of-factness, a this is how it is. Then, you know, as opposed to taking it personal, I'm such a terrible person or I'm such a great person. Oh, this is what's happening in the mind. I've lost my ease and this is why. And this ability to keep your ease when you see bad news in yourself, things that you don't like, is one of the great doorways to becoming free. So you see something about yourself, you know, you see that you're conceited, you're overly preoccupied, or that you're easily angered, or you're filled with lust and greed or something. And rather than being upset with it and losing more ease, the idea is to be content, to be honest about it and see it clearly. And in that contentment to see it clearly, oh, this is what's going on, keep your ease. Stay in a sense of ease. And so we're constantly using ease as a reference point. Come back. And it doesn't have to be dramatic ease, but it just means a little bit more than what you have, what you're having. You just kind of relax. So it can be just taking a deep breath and exhaling and relaxing. It can mean taking 30 seconds to close your eyes and breathe and just be present. It could mean looking around in where you are, especially if you're in a spacious place, and have your eyes wander around in the spacious place and look at the space and begin seeing how there's a lot of space to hold our thoughts. One of the forms of stress is when the mind gets claustrophobic, when there's just too many thoughts spinning around, it's all contracted and caught up. And sometimes to look around is a way of making more space in the mind to hold all the things that are going on, and it can create a sense of ease. Relaxing some of the tense muscles is very helpful. Relaxing the belly, the shoulders, the jaws. Not speaking too quickly. Sometimes just taking, not rushing to speak. It's sometimes a lot of stress gets built up when we feel compelled to speak, and we speak. Sometimes it's actually better not to just necessarily stay silent, but to wait and take a moment to breathe and be with yourself. It kind of keeps more ease. The other thing that's fascinating about ease as a reference point as a teacher for us is if you have a modicum of ease and you're going about your day and something happens where ordinarily you would lose your ease. You get excited, agitated, upset, alarmed, or something happens. So you notice it's happening, you're losing your ease. And then ask yourself the question, is this necessary? Is it necessary to lose my ease? What is it that I believe is so important that I'm willing to sacrifice my ease? And so this is where the debate comes in. And this is where you get to really kind of use your intelligence and your reflection and contemplation to really consider, you're losing your ease. Why are you doing that? Why is this so important? Why is it more important to lose your ease than to keep it? What is it so important that you'll sacrifice your ease for? So you're driving along on the freeway and you're maybe quite at ease. Nice day, not too much traffic. And someone comes along and cuts in front of you way too close. So it's alarming. You know, it's a little bit frightening, which is normal. But then you start noticing you're getting all hot and agitated. And you start ready to put, the person's already, the situation's already safe, but you're ready to honk your horn and do something interesting with your finger and... so why is important? So you've lost your ease. Why sacrifice your ease for someone who cut you off if you've managed to get safe again? What are you trying to accomplish? Is it worthwhile sacrificing your ease, giving it up for the sake of, somehow doing creative things with your finger to the person you're driving by? Why? What is more important? So I don't want, you probably can imagine what I think is the answer. So, you know, I apologize for that a little bit, just a little bit. But the point, if you're going to be your own teacher, is to engage in that questioning process. Really, don't just act on automatic impulse as if it's, you know, right thing to do, but question it, debate it. You know, yes, it's really important when someone cuts you off to, you know, for the next minute, hold your horn down and, you know, and yell out the window. It's, you know, and not notice anything else you're doing, driving, but that terrible person. You know, is that really that important? So this was just maybe a silly example, but you can probably think of many more throughout the day where you lose your ease. And then there's other things that happen, you know, on a large scale, like politics. Many people lose their ease. Or there's family tragedies that happen, you know, and we lose our ease. A friend of mine who was a hospice nurse told me once that there would come a point in caring for a patient that is the process of dying in the hospice, that she would go to the family members and say to the family, from now on, there's not going to be any more crisis. And crisis meant that everyone got alarmed and something has to be done, it's terrible, something has to happen. It's a natural process at some point to die. And so at some point in the hospice process, the person kind of turned the corner and it was clear that they were on their way out. And so the way she helped the family was say, there's no more crisis anymore. There's no reason to get alarmed, get all excited. We just stay calm, stay, keep our ease and stay present for it and support the person the best we can. I think it's a remarkable thing because the instinct is to get alarmed. We have to do whatever we can, you know, to fix the person. So this idea of getting alarmed by all kinds of things. And not a few people these days get alarmed by things that you're probably not going to have much, you know, impact whether you get alarmed or not. You know, just, you know, probably, does it really serve you? Does it serve the world to get alarmed? And some people get hysterical and all kinds of things that happen. Just before I came down here, my wife showed me a video that was, I guess, made today, yesterday, I don't know when it was, last few days, in Dallas, of there was a small group of African-Americans protesting the killing of black people by police. It's happening these days all over the country. And they were on one side of the street. And the other side of the street came counter-protesters, white people, young white men, in pickup trucks full of flags, American flags and Confederate flags. And they were saying, all lives matter, which is true, but it also diminishes the tremendous disparity of suffering that goes on, that's gone on for centuries here in this country. And so, you know, this was a setup for tension, right? And so there's a kind of a homemade video of what's going on, and the African American men, looks like they're consulting or something, and they shake hands like happily with each other, and then they walk across the street as a group, the whole group of maybe 20 or something, and they walk over to the group of maybe 10 white guys, and they give each other hugs, and all lives matter. And they get hugs and talk, and they're like best friends. Like, it was quite remarkable to watch. And then at some point the whole little encounter was going to end, I guess, and they all did a kind of huddle with hands over their shoulders, kind of like the football players or something. And one of them did a prayer. But what was most remarkable, there was a police officer who was there kind of in charge of keeping the public safety in this kind of situation. And by that time, the police officer joined them in a huddle. So I'm telling you the story now about ease because these African-Americans who decided to cross the street, the way it looked in the video, they did it with tremendous ease. It was the ease in which they did it that made it maybe possible for this kind of, you know, this kind of meeting to happen. Or then there's a photograph maybe many of you have seen now of the African-American woman in Baton Rouge who seems like she's totally composed and at ease, standing there very centered and dignified with her feet firmly on this road with a very light dress, kind of, because it's hot, I guess, down there, and very light kind of flowing dress. She looks almost like she should be, I don't know what. It's almost like, archetypical, the way she's standing there. And it looks like she has her eyes closed, and she looks like completely at ease and peaceful and present. And these two police officers with full riot gear on, walking towards her, a couple of feet away from her, ready to grab her, to arrest her. And the contrast was so dramatic. And but here, someone standing there with ease in a situation where she was protesting but keeping her ease as opposed to yelling and screaming and doing anything else. For at least for people like me, that sense of doing things like that with ease is much more powerful than the other ways that we can do things. So, but one point I wanted to make is about this, is many, many things to get excited about, get alarmed by, get hysteric by. I want to offer you a suggestion as you reflect on your loss of ease and your practice of ease, a suggestion to consider. And that is that one of the reasons we lose our ease is because we have a lack of self-confidence. The more unconfident we are about our ability to be effective, efficacious in the world that we live in, the more likely we are to lose our ease and get excited and concerned and alarmed. If we're confident that we can do something, there's no reason to get alarmed. Now, there's many things we can't, you know, do solve in the big picture of things, but to have confidence that we can do what we can do and what we can't do, there's no need to lose our calm about it. If we can't do anything about something, is that a reason to lose our calm? If our imagination tells us that whatever's happening is, we predict that in the future is going to cause all kinds of problems, and there's a lot of fear, that fear also has something to do with a lack of confidence that we'll know how to take care of ourselves in the future, do what we need to do. So you might disagree with me, and maybe it's not always true what I'm saying, but I think it's a very powerful reflection is to consider if part of the reason we lose our ease is comes from a lack of confidence. And if that's the case, where is your confidence? What do you have confidence in? How does one have confidence? What's the role of confidence in helping us keep our ease? And confidence has a lot to do with being able to do. Being at ease doesn't mean that we become passive. I hope that I hope that's not the case, you know, or indifferent. And so then finally, this thing about ease. Ease is when we tune in to the sense of ease or calm or peace that can exist for us, even if it's a small amount. If you really tune into it and notice what takes you away, you'll probably discover a trail, a path that opens up for you to deeper and deeper levels of peace, deeper and deeper levels of ease. And so you kind of sniff your way, you feel your way to the ease, to the ease. And as you do so, you'll find ways in which you start veering off to the left and the right. Oh no, not that. But watch the whole process. Watch the ways you leave it, question it, watch where you really feels good to be, where it feels satisfying or meaningful. And with time, my hope is you'll discover that you're much better off being at ease, that you're wiser, more creative, you're more effective in the world. All kinds of goodness can come from ease. And one of the things that to kind of get a sense of part of this goodness that can come from a sense of ease letting our mindfulness be strong in noticing what's happening inside of us as we sit and practice as we are, to notice the immediacy of what happens in our body, be really, mindfulness is a lot about bodyfulness. So really notice the effect, the consequence it has on our psychophysical system when we act one way or another way, when we feel one way or another way, when we have reaction one way or response another way, if we get alarmed or if we stay at ease. The movement of fight or flight. And the opposite of that is approach and soothe. Isn't that kind of nice? Approach and soothe. So how are we? So, and to notice the effect that has on us. And it's possible to notice, kind of in your brain, the feelings of health and healing and well-being that can come when we think in ways of ease and positively. And it's possible to feel the opposite, the sense of contraction and tightness and kind of stress that happens in the brain when we start thinking thoughts that are not so easeful, that are kind of stressful thoughts. And to watch, you know, to watch what kind of thoughts you have and to feel the effect it has on you physiologically is a very important piece of information. Because then maybe it becomes less interesting to have the thoughts that harm you and more interesting to have thoughts that benefit you, that support you. And ease is one of those kind of signposts or guides to help you move in the direction of kind of a way of being in the world that is actually nourishing for a psychophysical system. Not necessarily ease itself is always so nourishing, but it's kind of like makes a space, for room for some of the more the better aspects of our psyche, to our heart, to come forward. Ease creates room for what's good in us to come forth. Dis-ease, unease, tightens up the space, creates claustrophobic kind of feeling in the mind. And when things are tight in the mind, there's a lot of friction. And the friction is what produces a lot of the negative reactivity that we have. More space, less reactivity. More space, less reactivity. Less space, more reactivity. So ease. Ease as your teacher. And I'm pretty confident that if you really take this on as a teacher, something you reflect on and think and get familiar with, it takes a while to learn what it is. For some people, it takes a while to even recognize, what does he mean by ease? They're kind of confused. There's a story that's told in our Vipassana world of a woman who was on retreat, and during every couple of days in the retreat, there's a meeting with the teacher to talk about the practice. And this woman said, I feel something really strange. I'm not sure what it is, but it feels kind of odd. It feels different. It's strange to me. And the teacher, kind of in typical teacher way, said, well, just go back and keep looking at it. Keep investigating and see what it is. A couple of days later, the woman came back and said, I discovered what it is. I was calm. And I'm never calm. I never really knew what calm was. So, you know, it was such a strange feeling. She didn't recognize it because it was such a foreign thing to her. So it can be foreign. Ease and calm and a sense of inner peace can be a strange thing for us. But it might take a while to get a hang of it. And then as you get a hang of it, it takes a while to get a hang of how to use it as your teacher, how to use it as a guide, how to stay close to it, how not to sacrifice it so easily. Stay present with it and stay with it and learn to act in the world with your ease. It's really wonderful and worthwhile. So that's what I had to offer today. And we have about 10 minutes. If any of you would like to ask any questions or would like to champion unease, offer a counter view, you're very welcome. I saw this hand here first, if you can. And then if you can.
Thank you. One of the things that I've struggled with a lot in the past, both in my practice and the rest of my life, is I think when I was growing up, I had very quiet or self-controlled family. And so we just didn't express a lot of emotion, you know, and so either we were, you know, very calm or stoic or things like that, or we were even maybe suppressing a lot of emotion. And I don't think that's particularly healthy either, but I don't think that's what you're saying you should do. Like, you're not saying that you should suppress feeling or be unfeeling. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the difference between being at ease and suppressing things.
Yeah. First, I just want to say that different individuals, different families, different cultures, societies have different ways of being and expressing emotion. And we want to be a little bit careful not to say one is better than the other, that there are some that are more expressive and some and less, and there's just different ways of being. But certainly, I think being repressed or held down or not being truthful of what's going on can be very damaging, both to oneself and also to our relationships in the long term. And that's why I think mindfulness can be very helpful, because part of the instructions for, like, mindfulness meditation is to give full permission for us to be whatever we are at the moment and to really feel what's there. And it's one of the safest places in the world to let murderous rage course through us and be okay with it, you know, or be really afraid or be, you know, whatever's going on. And to make space for it and learn how we block it, learn how we inhibit, learn how we might repress it, and even not be truthful to ourselves about it. At least in that environment, to let it flow. And then once we have a sense of what that's like and know ourselves really well, because we're seeing all this, we're learning how to be at ease in the middle of our strong emotions, as opposed to being at ease at the expense of or pushing them down. So we kind of like making space for them to be there. Then you understand yourself better and well enough that you may be able to make much better choices about how to be with your emotions outside of meditation or, you know, in social situations. And there are some situations where maybe it's better to keep them to yourself. It's just more harmonious. And if you grew up in a family system where, you know, they didn't express emotions, they don't know how, it's kind of foreign to them, maybe it doesn't serve the family much for you to kind of be much more expressive, and maybe that should be done somewhere else. Or maybe it does serve them. Maybe it really helps everyone to break the ice and someone to kind of sit down and say, look, I'm having all these feelings here and I feel like I can't usually say what they are, and, you know, would it be nice after all these years, you think we could sit a little bit and I can share a little bit what I haven't said for all these years? And maybe they'll say yes. So hopefully we're wiser and we're able more. And through the mindfulness practice, we learn how not to be taken over by the emotions. We can allow them to course through us freely, but they're not in charge of us. We're in the driver's seat, but the kids are yelling in the back seat. I know, is that answer sufficient, or do you want to ask more?
It's something to think about, but I'll let other people ask questions.
Great. So this man here.
I think you sort of answered my question, but I'll ask anyway, just to go into the details of this particular emotion. How do you work with when you lose your ease to involuntary contractions like, say, anxiety or something that shows up and it just shows up?
Uh-huh. Yeah, good. Thank you for that. I think it's important not to listen to what I had to say and think that somehow that you failed, you're supposed to rush back to the ease and, you know, like, I get back into ease, you know, or I can't come to IMC anymore because I'm so anxious. I'm supposed to be at ease all the time. The basic mindfulness thing is to bring mindfulness to that anxiety. And if you can, it might be helpful to have the idea that you're trying to be at ease with the anxiety. Not at ease in spite of the anxiety, but at ease with it being there. And that kind of makes space for you to look at it, feel it, be with it. It also makes space for you're kind of like stepping away a little bit from the anxiety, in a sense, from being the anxiety that's kind of feeding it and continuing the stories and the ideas that's going there, and kind of making space to see it and allow it to kind of unfold without us fueling it. Does that make sense? So it's, to be any anxiety we have deserves our respect and our care. It's not a mistake. It's part of the path to open to it and to feel it and to make space and just feel it and bring to it. And one of the great ways, both literally and also metaphorically, the idea of doing it in meditation is very helpful. That you know, you sit down in meditation and just make a lot of space to really be present and feel it, and hopefully not to get caught up in it and spiral out of, you know, into panic attacks, but to feel it so that kind of it begins to kind of not control the situation totally, but there's space for it and allow for it. Feel it in the body. Metaphorically, we can also do that in daily life. It doesn't have to be meditation. We can maybe take a moment to, or a few moments, just to feel what's going on rather than being pushed around by the emotion. Does that make sense?
Thank you.
Great. Someone else? It's a lot of men. Women don't have this issue. There are any issues here today? Okay. So I saw the hand over there. If you can move it.
So for a long time, I've made a very big effort not to express my anger in ways that are damaging, right? If I feel I have an impulse or a reaction that's angry, I'll kind of try and sit with it and let it pass. But I end up getting walked on a lot.
You what?
I end up getting kind of, sometimes I have maybe a little bit of trouble setting boundaries because of that. I'll have an impulse to lash out or to somehow defend myself. So recently I've been, it's just the situations have become what they are. And it has become too much. And I've started, you know, as a means of maybe setting some boundaries, becoming very angry. And it's been very effective, sadly enough.
In the short term.
Exactly. And I can definitely, I can feel it, the habit permeating the rest of my reactions. I can feel it becoming easier to become angry and over smaller things. And I also feel definitely a loss of ease. So what I would love to hear about is how you can be firm and easy, how you can have integrity and work towards setting good boundaries without, you know, going to a place that's scary or angry or something like that.
Yeah. Generally, I believe when people are angry, the primary problem with anger is the hostility that might be with it. And so hostility causes a lot of damage. It can be effective. But one of the dramatic stories I have in my life of seeing how being firm and strong was kind of productive was when raising my kids. And I have every once in a while, very rarely, but sometimes my older son, I used my strong voice. And that got his attention. And, you know, there was some behavior that was just kind of out of, you know, just unacceptable. And you had to, somehow stop. So I had to use my strong voice to stop it. So, oh, good. That's effective parenting, just a strong voice. And, you know. And then one day I heard him use exactly the same voice on his younger brother. I said, oh, no. What have I done? You know, so then one day, you know, I tried to do it another way. I told him, if you continue doing what you're doing, I'm going to get angry. And he stopped and he looked at me and said, you're already angry. And then I wasn't angry anymore. One of the things you might consider doing, which is I do also, is when I'm angry, I try to not act on my anger. But I don't want to ignore the situation either, and there's something needs to be done. And if I have the chance, I go for a walk. Something that walks for me are really good when I'm angry. And I try to understand more deeply what is going on for me, what's the impact, what's really happening for me. Because I like to think of anger as a secondary emotion, and there's something deeper going on that's more interesting. more important to notice. And for me, the primary two has been fear and hurt. And when I discover the fear and the hurt, then I can go back to the person and say, you know, when you said that, I'm really afraid. Or when you say that, I feel really hurt. And most people stop for that. That changes the whole conversation very differently. So you're making I statements, whereas anger, often you're making you statements. And so you make an I statement, oh, I feel really afraid. And I don't know if I want to continue. It's hard for me to continue. I don't know if it makes sense for me to keep doing this. Or I think I need to somehow create some boundaries here. And so you state it very explicitly, but if you make it more of an I statement and your needs, then there's less room for the person to get defensive, and they understand you better, and hopefully they can kind of, most people then will respond in a good way. If they don't respond in a good way, that's good information to have. Because then you know what you're up against. And then probably being angry wouldn't have, you know, been so effective either. And so then maybe you have to think some other strategy and figure out how to take care of yourself. So that's just, I mean, it's a lot to be said, but that's, is that okay?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. So it's almost time. So unless there's a woman who would like to say something. Okay. So, so if anything I've said this evening makes you uneasy, you can do one of two things. Maybe many things, but two things occur to me. You could either be curious and investigate what's going on for you and what's going on, what you're responding to with what I said. Debate it, consider it, reflect on it. And maybe you'll come out ahead. Maybe I can learn something from you. The second thing you can do is whatever caused you unease, just leave it here. Don't take it with you. And continue going about your life at ease. So thank you all very much.